This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. There's a fascinating race for Vermont's open seat for lieutenant governor this year. It's a race where the two major party candidates view the role of government quite differently. As part of VPR's ongoing coverage of the 2016 campaign, today I'll be talking with the Republican candidate seeking the office, Randy Brock. In his political career, Mr. Brock has served as state auditor. He's represented Franklin County in the state Senate. And he's also he was the GOP candidate for governor in 2012. Randy Brock, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Bob, thank you very much.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. What are your thoughts about this race for lieutenant governor? What are some of the key issues that you want the next lieutenant governor to address? You know, in some states, voters elect the governor and lieutenant governor together as a team. It's not an independently elected position. Should Vermont consider that approach, or perhaps not? And the role of lieutenant governor is pretty limited. Should it be expanded? How would you do that? Your thoughts about the race for lieutenant governor? 1-800-639-2211. So, Randy, the role of lieutenant governor is pretty limited in state government. Officially, when the legislature is in session, the lieutenant governor serves as the presiding officer of the Senate. That's usually a 4 or 5 month commitment. At the beginning of the session, they help determine committee assignments in the Senate, and they certainly serve as acting governor whenever the governor goes out of state. So just to start off with today, tell our listeners, what attracts you to the post of lieutenant governor?
Well, I think you forgot one thing, Bob, about the role of lieutenant governor. And I've said jokingly that the job of lieutenant governor is to wake up every morning and inquire diligently into the governor's health. But that belies a really serious issue of what the real role of lieutenant governor is, and that is to be able to take over from the governor in the event of tragedy. And we know that 5 times in Vermont history, starting with our first governor, Thomas Chittenden, in 1797, that's happened. And most recently, when Governor Dick Snelling died in 1991, that's what brought Howard Dean to the governor's office. That's a really important role, and the person filling that role has to be able to assume the job of governor based on background, experience, knowledge, and all of the characteristics necessary to be able to keep government moving forward. And that's really an important task.
I'm glad you brought that up. Usually the lieutenant governor tries to highlight a few priority issues. What would those be for you?
Well, I've said that's the real appeal for the lieutenant governor's job for me, is that the governor so often is focused on dealing with the issues that are at hand. In other words, how to get this budget balanced, how to deal with the fires that are burning when he or she takes office. The lieutenant governor has kind of a blank page aside from the duties that we've mentioned and can turn that office into what he or she thinks is the best thing for Vermont. And for me, my focus, I've said 3 things that I'm focused on. The first is jobs in the economy. The second is jobs in the economy. And the third is jobs in the economy. I think we need a real focus. And we need a real focus on not just the issue of the so-called crisis of affordability, which I believe is very real. But to me, to make Vermont affordable implies that we're going to make Vermont a place that you can live paycheck to paycheck, and that's not good enough. We need someone who is thinking about the future of what Vermont is going to be 5 years, 10 years, or 15 years down the road, and thinking about what we need to do in order to get there to a place where we have a vibrant economy in Vermont, a Vermont that's not just affordable, but it's a place that people want to come, people want to live, people want to grow businesses, and a place where our kids won't have to leave in order to find a job someplace else. Those are the areas that I intend to focus on as lieutenant governor.
What do you think is the single most important step that could be taken to create more good-paying jobs in Vermont?
A change in attitude at the top. You know, tone at the top is critically important in any enterprise, either in business or in government. And that is making a clear statement and a clear message that Vermont is open for business, that we want jobs and that we will work hard to get the kinds of jobs that will help us move Vermont forward. Tone at the top is critically important to get that message across. But what's equally important is tone at the middle. Tone at the middle of the organization, so that at all levels of state government, the message is clear that the job of people in government is to help their friends and neighbors, to deal with them as customers and as friends and neighbors in order to accomplish real things that benefit all of us. There is right now so often a feeling that people aren't in control of their lives, that government in some cases doesn't listen to them. And we have to, as leaders in government, make sure that that message carries through throughout state government, that we are listening, that we are responsive, that we've got an open door and an open mind.
You don't think the 6 years of the Shumlin administration have been an effort to say that Vermont's open for business and that the governor has wanted to create thousands of new jobs?
Well, that has not happened. If you take a look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers, we have a smaller labor force than we did at the beginning of the Great Recession in December of 2007, and we have a smaller number of people working in Vermont than worked at that time. We're 49th in the nation in terms of population growth. That demographic loss is particularly acute in that 25 to 44-year-old class of people who really are the lion's share of the earners in Vermont. So despite whatever efforts have been voiced about creating jobs and opportunity, we haven't done a particularly good job in doing that.
Vermont's unemployment rate, one of the lowest in the country.
Well, it's because the people who would be looking for work in a lot of cases have left to go someplace else. We have a problem, yes, about jobs being available to people. We have a very small unemployment rate, but we don't have the kind of job growth that we need in order to deal with things like the lower student-teacher ratio, the lower number of kids that we have in school overall, which has caused that ratio to change as much as it has. We have a problem with population, and we also have a disconnect between the people who are available to work and the jobs that we have. Time and time again, we hear from employers that, gee, we would like people who are better qualified to work, and we're having difficulty getting them. That, too, is a problem we have to deal with.
Today on the program, our guest is Randy Brock, the Republican candidate seeking the office for lieutenant governor. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Richard, who's calling from Montpelier. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program.
Hey, good afternoon. Recently, the Domestic Violence Fatality Review Commission released their report and said that 6 out of 16 homicides in Vermont were domestic violence homicides. And I'm wondering, background checks for guns, why not background checks for guns so that people can't pass guns on without checks to convicted domestic violence people? Why are you protecting those abusers? And I'll take that call off the air.
So the issue is, should Vermont have universal background checks for all gun sales in the state?
Well, there's the question of the statistics that were used regarding the number of deaths from domestic violence. And there's certainly, at least if those are of the most recent year, those numbers do not constitute the total number of deaths, certainly do not constitute the number of deaths from firearms, which, as I recall, were somewhere in the neighborhood of 2. I've seen no evidence looking at a long history of not just domestic violence, but of mass killings in general over the past 35 years, that the kinds of gun laws that are being proposed right now would have had any difference, not just any material difference, but really any difference in the overall number of gun deaths. Vermont is the safest state in the country in terms of violence, criminal violence. We have laws that are at the federal level that do provide some very in-depth checks of people who are purchasing guns. People talk here in Vermont about the so-called gun show loophole, and What we're finding is that at gun shows in Vermont, the dealers are, in fact, dealers, and the people who buy guns at gun shows go through the same background check that they do at a gun store. So I'm concerned about creating a regime that adds a great deal of difficulty for people exercising their rights under the Second Amendment and under the 16th article of the Vermont Constitution for no material benefit.
So you would say no to expanding background checks?
I believe that Vermont's gun laws are adequate as they are. And I think the result that we see in the lowest in the nation gun violence statistics reflect that. We see a lot of jurisdictions, such as Chicago, for example, that have very extensive gun laws that have extremely high murder rates. It suggests that those gun laws have not been effective in achieving any material result that benefits those populations.
Let's talk to Bill, who's calling from Underhill. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
Yes, my question has to do with Vermont Health Connect. The governor last week or earlier this week said that everything is up and working. I'm on Vermont Health Connect, but I don't believe. I think there are still issues out there, and I wanted to know where Mr. Brock stood with Vermont Health Connect.
I believe we should disconnect it. I've been writing about Vermont Health Connect since before it began, and very consistently, as I've looked at it in depth, I found it to be a thoroughly dysfunctional system that was both badly designed, badly architected, badly overseen, and badly managed. I'm also very concerned about the transparency that's been associated with Vermont Health Connect. Time and time again, we've heard that story that everything is fine, that it's up and working, and that it's improving. But then when we do Open Records Act searches and take a look at the underlying data, such as the number of people who are complaining, the amount of wait time there is in order to get service, and then anecdotally, when we talk to scores, if not hundreds of people who relate story after story after story of not getting the coverage they paid for, of being put on hold for hours at a time, and for an unresponsive system, I believe that enough is enough. It's time to pull the plug on what has been the most expensive per capita system in the United States and do what 40 other states have done and move to the federal exchange for a variety of reasons.
Now, right now, with Vermont Health Connect, low- and middle-income Vermonters are able to get subsidies for the state, both in terms of subsidy premiums and also to reduce some of their out-of-pocket costs. It's around $6 million a year. That's going to be much more difficult to achieve with the federal exchange.
Well, at least people will get coverage. And I think our goal, certainly in healthcare, should be to try to ensure that 100% of Vermonters can get available and affordable healthcare. Our focus so much has been on how to figure out paying for healthcare by moving these deck chairs around, when our focus should much more be on how do we actually lower the cost of healthcare. And we're not spending nearly enough time focusing on that.
I guess what supporters of Vermont Health Connect would say is that your plan to go to the federal exchange will actually increase costs and premiums for the people, lower income and middle income people. And how does that jive with your idea of trying to make healthcare more affordable?
Well, I think it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing. The devil obviously is in the details of how you do that and the particular arrangements that you make with the federal government to achieve that. Now, the federal government and the National Healthcare Exchange obviously isn't the only answer. We certainly have had discussions with Connecticut, for example, about talking about joining another state-level exchange. Now, there theoretically there are advantages for doing that. But the disadvantages come from the fact that we now are looking at spending something like $56 million a year just to maintain Vermont Health Connect in terms of operating cost for a system that basically is designed to serve 34,000 people, a relatively small number of people. By saving some of the money that we're going to spend in ongoing maintenance costs, that's not to say that the state can't do something else in terms of subsidies or whatever we decide is the best thing to do once we get our costs defined vis-a-vis the solution that we're going to choose in order to provide additional help for people who need help. Vermont has always been good about doing that. Vermont has always been sensitive about doing that. And I'm certainly open to look at how best to do that. But what I do know is that continuing to use a dysfunctional system that doesn't serve Vermonters well and that has huge cost and will have an even greater cost for maintenance, repair, and changes as healthcare changes over time is not a wise use of the public's money.
So the governor is pursuing what he calls the all-payer waiver in Washington. The goal is to do away with the current fee-for-service system, reward quality of work, not quantity of work. Do you support that approach?
I think it's a very interesting approach, and it's one that we should explore further. Now, one of the problems about the all-payer waiver is we don't really know anything about it because it's been negotiated in secret. So we don't have any of the details of what the all-payment waiver will involve. Now, apparently from leaked reports, if you will, there will be some federal money that will be provided in order to assist in the transition. But the key is what federal money, how much, and what kind of assistance will be provided. Most of the healthcare providers that I've spoken with, and I've spoken to folks from independent practitioners, to people involved in the insurance industry, to hospital CEOs, a number of whom I spoke with, in fact, at an event in Manchester last night. There's a lot of interest in pursuing a form of payment reform such as we're talking about with an all-payer waiver. But the question about all of it is whether or not we can produce a system that reduces the number of unintended consequences. When you do a capitated payment system, for example, in which you pay for keeping people healthy, we want to make sure we don't create disincentives for providers to treat people who are sick by shifting them to other providers. It's those kinds of details that we really need to understand before we say this is a good or a bad idea. The second thing we need to be concerned about particularly is Medicare. If all of these Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance is in the same pot, and the goal is to ensure that the people, providers who are getting Medicaid payments get their prices raised, where's that money going to come from unless there is an additional source of revenue coming into the system? Those are the questions that haven't been answered yet. And before you can opine on the all-payer waiver, you need answers to those questions.
Today in the program, we're talking to Randy Brock, the Republican candidate for lieutenant governor. Your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today I'm talking to Randy Brock, the Republican candidate for lieutenant governor. Your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Sean, who is calling from Swanton. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the program.
Mr. Brock, I have a question. What is your stance on legalization of marijuana for the state? I know Mr. Zuckerman's pretty well in where he stands with it. I just have a quick question on how you feel on that subject. Thank you.
On marijuana legalization, I would never say never. I think there may come a time when it's something that we in Vermont should consider, but I don't think that now is the time. And I say that for a variety of reasons, the first of which is I've spoken throughout the state to educators, to medical professionals, to law enforcement professionals, and virtually 100% of the people that I've spoken with have given me some very strong reasons as to why this is not a good idea at this time, ranging from the effect of marijuana on the adolescent brain to the likelihood of increased usage, particularly among youth, which seems to have happened in Colorado, all of those things is coupled with the fact that we don't have an effective test to be able to determine impairment on driving, and the highway safety issue is also of concern. And the statistics we're seeing from some of the more recent reports from Colorado suggest that there may be increased highway fatalities. I think we need to have more time to really assess what's happened in those jurisdictions that have legalized recreational use of marijuana so that we have some facts upon which to base our decisions going forward. I know we have this tendency on things like this in Vermont to want to be first in the nation. And I think that it's wise for us to wait to examine what's happened elsewhere and to make decisions on the basis of facts. I don't think I'd want to be the first person in the United States to have had a heart transplant. And I take that same analogy to things like this.
So supporters of legalization, some of them would say, hey, it's very clear, prohibition doesn't work. It's not working. What we need is a legalized system that is regulated by the state.
Well, that's what they say, but we don't know that for a fact, that whether or not there is, in fact, a legalized system that will be better than what we have right now. We have a decriminalized system. We're not locking up people who smoke a joint for the first time in their life. Kids are not packing the jails because of marijuana use. We also know that, based on what we see, that legalizing it doesn't eliminate the black market. There are still the Mexican drug traffickers who import marijuana. They don't have to pay the wages that we would in Vermont for the growers of marijuana. They don't have to subscribe to the legalization rules and regulations that we might impose. And from all of the evidence that I'm seeing from elsewhere, they're not. It doesn't eliminate the black market, but what it does do is it gives us an increase, particularly in youth marijuana use. There was a point in time in which Vermont was first in the nation in marijuana use among young people, and that now has been surpassed by Colorado, which is not at all surprising. I'm not sure that this is the message that we want to send our kids, particularly when the medical community is consistently telling us that heavy marijuana usage among young people does, in fact, have an effect on the adolescent brain.
Do you think in this decriminalized atmosphere that Vermonters should be able to grow a plant or two of their own without the threat of being arrested?
Well, that's a difficult question, only because a plant or two becomes two plants or two becomes, again, a Wild West situation. Well, let's also just remember one thing. Marijuana is a Schedule I drug. It is illegal under federal law. Whether we think that law is sensible or not is immaterial. The point is that we're where we are in the states on marijuana now because we have an administration that's chosen not to enforce the marijuana law. That is not necessarily always going to be the case. We could have an election, for example, in November, in which through the stroke of a pen, subsequently, a federal bureaucrat could decide to enforce laws. To create an entire industry on the basis of something that's illegal under federal law, I think is unwise. I think also when I hear David talking about the vast amounts of revenues that we will get from marijuana, the numbers don't support what he's saying. They don't support the kinds of programs that David and Sue Minter want to create using marijuana revenue. The Joint Fiscal Office number, which is the number that Vermont used in its analysis of marijuana, the marijuana bill in the last session, showed that we would get about $20 million in revenue. Now, they're currently saying, well, yes, we may get a lot more than that. We used a relatively low number. But when we look at Colorado, where we have actual numbers of marijuana sales, of revenues coming to the state from marijuana, if we take that revenue number, compare it to Colorado's state budget, Colorado's a much larger state than we are, it means that about 0.35% of the revenues in the state of Colorado came from marijuana. When we apply that number to Vermont's state budget, we would get $19.4 million, which is very consistent with the $20 million of the JFO estimate. What I'm saying is this is not the cash cow that David would have you believe it is.
You were talking about how things could change in November, depending on who's elected. We got an email here from Nichol, who wants to know, will you be voting for Donald Trump, the Republican candidate for president?
I've said repeatedly that I'm going to vote for a Republican in November, and it will not be Donald Trump.
Why not? Why not Donald Trump?
Well, I did an op-ed, it was back in December, in which I detailed it. It was widely circulated. You can look it up on Digger, the Free Press, the Rutland Herald, and so on. And my concern is that He's not what we need as he's not what we need as a president. I'm just concerned about the bullying, the racist comments, the inappropriate statements, and his history in which he has been literally all over the board in terms of what he believes in and what he supports. He's not, in my mind, what we need as a president to lead the United States.
So who would you like to see elected president in November? Somebody is going to be elected president, presumably. Who would you like that to be?
I would like it to be none of the above based on the candidates who are out there right now. And I know that may not be the case. And I've certainly heard the argument that, well, if you don't vote for Donald Trump, you've made a tacit vote for Hillary Clinton. I don't believe that Hillary Clinton is the right person to be president. But I have to live with my conscience. My conscience will not allow me to vote for Donald Trump, and I'm not going to do it.
Do you think Donald Trump is a worse choice than Hillary Clinton?
Well, that's like asking me, would I rather be drawn and quartered or boiled in oil?
And do you see the two of them as basically being the same?
I see both of them as being flawed candidates. And I'm very concerned, as I think many Americans are, that we have a process in the United States in which we have over 300 million people, and this is the best we could come up with. I think we need to work very hard. I think both of the parties, the major parties, as well as independents do, to see that 4 years from now, we're not where we are right now.
Let's talk about energy a little bit. I'd like to get your thoughts on industrial wind or industrial solar projects that are being proposed around the state of Vermont. Do you think that individual towns should have veto power over the siting of these kinds of projects in their communities?
I believe in the concept of substantial deference, meaning that towns should have a seat at the table, and the people who are affected by these projects should be heard. And what I hear more and more and more from people throughout the state whose homes, whose way of life is threatened by industrial wind projects in particular, feel impotent. They feel that we have a government that and a process that doesn't listen to them. And I think we need to change that process so that we do listen to people. Now, that being said, I'm reminded, in fact, I think I put out a piece of paper, maybe an email, a few days ago, in which I recalled a Vietnam experience where there was a village, Ben Tre, in the Mekong Delta, that had been overrun by the Viet Cong. The response was to bomb that village into oblivion so that nothing was left standing, and it led to that iconic epitaph from a military officer who said it became necessary to destroy the village in order to save it. And as I look at industrial wind and the ridges, the mountain ridges in Vermont, I'm reminded of that statement, and I'm very concerned that we're going to destroy the environment in order to save it. And I don't think that that's a wise thing for us to do.
Because there are people who think that towns should have veto power, and they look at the law that was passed by the legislature this year, giving communities substantial deference under certain circumstances to be in compliance with regional and state planning. Those folks look at this new law and say, you know, in the end, they don't have a final say, that the Public Service Board can go right ahead and approve this project, even though a majority of people in the community oppose it.
Well, I think that that issue of substantial deference and what the details are in terms of the circumstances in which these projects are not improved, particularly in terms of issues such as siting and runoff and noise, those are the things that have not been defined in the law that need to be defined better. And if they are defined better so that people understand them and so that, above all, the Public Service Board understands them, then the issue of substantial deference takes on an entirely different meaning, and it takes on a meaning that we can all support. Right now, it does not.
What are your thoughts about this natural gas pipeline that's being built over in the western part of the state to bring gas down from Burlington, Middlebury, Rutland, under the lake, to Ticonderoga? Is this a good project?
I don't know, quite frankly. I've heard mixed feelings about it. When I was in the Senate, I had the the privilege of sitting on the Natural Resources and Energy Committee, where bills like that come through, where you could actually listen to the testimony and look at the underlying issues surrounding a bill. And unfortunately, as this was developing, that was after the time that I sat on that committee. I'd want to do, I think, a lot more in-depth research before firmly saying that I'm absolutely opposed or absolutely against this particular pipeline. I understand the basic issues in terms of the need for natural gas. I do have a question as to whether that need, particularly in Ticonderoga, should take precedence over the feelings of the people whose properties are taken by eminent domain and whose properties are infringed upon by that particular pipeline. And that is a real judgment question as to whether the public interest rises to the point that a pipeline like that should go through. I'm also concerned, based on what I know about at this point, about the costs associated with it, the costs that ultimately might be borne by ratepayers, as to whether or not the cost estimates are substantially over what was originally represented. All of these things, I think, would be factors in my decision, but I haven't made a final decision as yet.
Randy Brock is the Republican candidate running for lieutenant governor. Randy, many thanks for being on the program today.
Well, thank you very much, Bob, for having me. There are 1,000 more things that we could and should talk about, and I hope you'll have me back sometime.
We absolutely will, no doubt about it. Coming up next, we're going to take a look at one of the hottest U.S. Senate races in the country. It's taking place in New Hampshire, and the outcome of this contest could help determine which party controls the U.S. Senate in January. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Well, one of the closest and most important Senate races in the country is going on right next door to Vermont. It's over in New Hampshire, where incumbent Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte is facing off against the current Democratic governor of the state, Maggie Hassan. It's a hard-fought and very expensive contest. It has the possibility of determining which party controls the U.S. Senate in January. Here to tell us about this race is New Hampshire Public Radio senior politics and public policy editor Dan Barrick. Dan, great to have you back on Vermont Edition.
Thanks, Bob.
So, Dan, could you introduce these candidates for us? It seems like they're both pretty well-known and relatively well-liked figures in their respective parties in New Hampshire. Is that the case?
It is, yeah. Both of those are true. And this race itself has kind of been in the making for a long time. It feels like they've been running against each other even before the, you know, Governor Hassan became an official candidate. Governor Hassan's been the governor for 4 years now. Senator Ayotte, as you said, is the incumbent 6 years. But before that, they both had long careers in state politics. Ayotte was the state's attorney general for several years before running for the Senate. Hassan had served in the New Hampshire Senate and as majority leader. They're both, without a doubt, the most powerful members of their parties, their respective parties in New Hampshire, and both really represent kind of the mainstream of the parties there within New Hampshire. Within the national sort of political ideology, they're both fairly moderates within their parties. They both talk a lot on the campaign trail about bipartisanship. They're both fairly conservative in temperament, not ideologically conservative, but neither one is really kind of an aggressive or natural campaigner. And I think you sort of see that on the trail. They both seem to be kind of almost joylessly slogging it out here. In part, I think that's a reflection of the national political climate and the kind of impact that the presidential race has had on voter mood. But I think they've been eyeing each other for some time now, and there's been little movement within the race itself. I think because of that, there've been little shift in either tactic or within the polls. They've both really been neck and neck for, as I said, for months now.
And Dan, why is this race so important on a national level?
Well, it's this is a place New Hampshire's found itself for a good decade or so now. One of these reliably swing states, battleground states. As we said, the Ayotte Hassan race. They're both well-funded candidates. They are both. They're both have fairly high approval ratings for their current jobs, which is unusual. I think they both got around 50. Hassan's actually got about a 60% approval rating. Ayotte's about 50%. So they're both well-liked. And with the Senate really in the balance, a dollar in New Hampshire can go a lot further than a dollar spent on a race in North Carolina or Florida. So we are seeing just a ton of outside money being spent in this race. I think we had a report this week, latest figure, about $50 million in outside non-candidate money. So that's coming from, you know, Senate Majority PAC, outside groups like One Nation that are really trying to sway this race. And not surprisingly, the vast majority of that spending is being spent to smear the other candidates. So you're seeing a lot of very negative mail, a lot of very negative TV ads. But the investment here on this race as one of the, you know, a half dozen or so that could sway the U.S. Senate composition in January, it's really getting into crunch time here.
Dan, did I hear you correctly? Did you say $50 million?
$50 million, yeah. And again, that's just outside spending, which has already set a record for New Hampshire for the most expensive race in history. The candidates themselves have spent about another $10 million or so on top of that. So, you know, we're in mid-September here, another six weeks or so, and we're already talking, you know, $60 million bucks. So it's definitely, and as I said, all that outside attention. So that you can sort of feel the pressure here on the ground in terms of how much is at stake at this race.
Dan, you mentioned it's pretty close in the polls. What are some of the factors that could influence this race in the next 6 weeks? Are there some debates coming up? What could influence it?
Yeah, the two candidates have not really engaged each other one-on-one much. Just this week was really the first time they actually shared a stage for campaign purposes. Ayotte actually had a primary challenger that she dispatched with fairly easily. In terms of issues, I mean, the main issues, it's interesting. You have two candidates who are trying to run in this mode that has been very successful for New Hampshire politicians for the last 20 years or so, which is a real emphasis on bipartisanship, on common sense. So both candidates sort of running with that playbook. Ayotte is calling attention to those areas, those policy matters where she has shown some leanings towards bipartisanship or actually bucking her party's leadership. That would be her support for some carbon emission goals, her efforts toward immigration reform, her work at the federal level on the opioid crisis. Hassan and her allies are trying to, not surprisingly, point out those areas where Ayotte is to the right and in some ways out of the, you know, sort of at maybe not with following voter sentiment, particularly around guns and abortion and Planned Parenthood. In terms of issues, it's hard to know. And I think one thing we're seeing is just the influence that the presidential race is having, and particularly for Kelly Ayotte, her very at times awkward attempt to distance herself from Donald Trump. Your listeners may be familiar with this line she's been using pretty much since it became clear Trump would win the Republican presidential nomination, that she would support but not endorse Donald Trump, meaning she would vote for him but not urge others to do the same, which is a very sort of groundbreaking terminology. Ayotte is a Clinton supporter, so I think that will influence the climate at the top. But on the flip side, while Hillary Clinton has maintained a fairly steady lead over Donald Trump in the state, I think the most recent poll had her up by about 9% over Trump, the Ayotte-Hassan race has remained pretty tight. So it does at least indicate that Ayotte is managing to persuade voters that she's not in lockstep with Trump and that they can, you know, some number of voters can comfortably cast a ballot for Clinton and also for her. What, you know, how the presidential race, the dynamic of that plays out over the next month and a half, I think will go a long way towards shaping the Senate race.
So, Senator, Ayotte is really walking a fine line there. Do you think most people are accepting her idea that she'll support Donald Trump, but she won't endorse him?
Well, you know, that the Democrats are definitely trying to make that about a big part of the race. I mean, it's hard to go to any event with Governor Hassan or any kind of part of the Democratic establishment here and have them not put Ayotte and Trump in the same sentence. But the polls indicate that she is. And as I said, this is a model that has worked, you know, successful New Hampshire politicians, Washington politicians, you know, current Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Judd Gregg. They project this, there's this formula of what, you know, what they call kind of common sense New Hampshire moderation and bipartisanship that she is that she's really trying to bring to the campaign trail. The other thing she does have going against her, though, is this recent history of, in presidential years, Democrats really running the table. So, you know, you look back to 2012 and 2008, the last two presidential election years, Democrats ran the table. They won in New Hampshire. They won the presidential Democratic presidential nominee won in New Hampshire. Democrats won the governor's seat, both congressional seats, the Senate seat in those years. That is a tide of history that Ayotte is really going to have to do hard to swim against. But so far, she seems to at least be, to continue this metaphor, to at least be treading water there.
It's going to be fascinating to see how this race turns out. Dan Barrick is senior political and public policy editor for New Hampshire Public Radio. Dan, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
That is Vermont Edition for today. Coming up on Monday, the University of Vermont is taking a leading role in a massive national study on the developing brains of kids and teenagers. We'll talk with researchers on what they aim to discover about the adolescent mind. Send your questions or comments to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen live Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.